Stretches, scales, and warm-ups to be led. 1, 2, 3, have a line change or 11. All the chaos,
simply heaven.
Here comes new song, number 7.
Cue the trumpets here instead.
Anything can happen in the theater. Why wait another moment, take a seat. For here's a secret, something every theater artist knows.
It's the audience that makes the show complete.
Plus the jokes that make us laugh.
And the dancers taking wing. And the nice box office staff.
Plus the high notes people see.
Whoa, nice.
Though it's surprised you may react, it's a sweet and simple fact
that anything can happen in the theater.
And welcome to Broadway Radios This Week on Broadway for Sunday, April 23rd, 2017. My name is James Marino, and on the broadcast today we have Peter Felicia, Michael Portantier, Carrie Purcell. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books. His most recent is The Great Parade, available everywhere. His columns appear at MTI, Masterworks Broadway, Broadway Select, and many other places. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears to Talk in Broadway, Everything Sondheim, and Broadway Stars. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and other major publications. You could see his photography work at fallspotphoto.com. Good morning, Michael.
Morning.
Good morning. Also with us is a longtime returning host, Carrie Purcell. Yay, Carrie. Carrie is a freelance journalist who has been published in American Theater Magazine, Playbill, The Culture Trip, Paste Magazine, The Village Voice, and many other publications. Follow her on Twitter at Carrie Purcell. Carrie, welcome back.
Hello.
Hello. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Today joining us, we have two very special guests. Julie Andrews and Emmy Walton are joining us via telephone. If you are listening to the show, I hardly think that you need an introduction to these two women, but just in case, I will tell you that Broadway fans know Julie from appearances on Broadway of The Boyfriend, My Fair Lady, Camelot, and Victor Victoria. Just some of her millions of screen credits include Cinderella, Mary Poppins, The Sound of Music, and Thoroughly Modern Millie. Emma Walton Hamilton, who happens to be the daughter of Julie, is a Broadway producer, an executive producer, and writer on Julie's Green Room. Julie and Emma, thank you so much for joining us on Broadway Radio. We're very excited to talk with you about your show, Julie's Green Room, which is playing right now on Netflix. I watched it last night with my daughter, who's 9 years old, and we loved it. Tell us, how did this project come up? This is so exciting.
Well, I'll go first, I think. It's something that I've long wanted to do, James. Both Emma and I were passionate about the arts, and I've always wanted to bring the arts to children, to young children, and to try to give them a sense of wonder and joy about it and get them involved. And, you know, they're so threatened these days with budget restrictions and so on. And it just seemed like a no-brainer when the lovely Henson Company asked if I'd like to do something in this vein, and I said I would love to, and Emma and I came aboard, and then Netflix very kindly have our back, so to speak, and it's just been a wonderful fulfillment of something I've always wanted to do.
Hi, Julie. How are you? You are always saying how lucky you were to be involved in films like The Sound of Music and Mary Poppins. But it struck me that those films themselves can be viewed as arts education.
Of course. Nothing is ever not really educational. I mean, there's just so much out there for children to enjoy. If it's ballet and music and opera and writing and everything from puppetry to magic to instruments in the orchestra, and there's just so much out there that could be, is art.
And I think part of what we wanted to do also was to introduce kids to the actual specifics of the performing arts. For those children perhaps who can't or don't have access to Broadway, or who are in another country perhaps, and have never seen ballet or
what it is like backstage.
Right, or what it's like backstage, or never learned the vocabulary of the performing arts. I think that's part of what we were trying to achieve. And because we are such arts advocates, and for many years I ran a theater similar to the one that Mom's character runs in our show.
Yes.
We're so aware of the impact that the arts can have on kids' success, both in school and in life beyond. And, the statistics bear that out.
But particularly, it's always said that musicals incorporate all of the arts. So in a way, they're such a wonderful way to bring...
I'm glad you're the one that's saying it.
Well, and, the thing is, music, of course, is math. And so when we're studying music, we are actually strengthening our math skills as well. I mean, there's so much synergy there and so much overlap. And people forget that.
Now, Patty Duke and William Shallard were daughter and father on her TV show, and William Shallard told me that it was very hard for him after she became SAG president, which he was too, that he kept on being like a father to her, even though he didn't want to be. Is it hard for you to be co-hosts when the role of mother and daughter has been going on for so many years?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, it doesn't. So far, it's never gotten in the way, has it?
No. We're not actually co-hosts. Mom performs on the show. I don't. I'm strictly behind the scenes. I'm one of the writers. I'm a co-creator of the show and an executive producer and one of the writers, but as is Mom, all those three things as well. But she's the only one actually performing in the show.
But in fact, we do work together a great deal. We've, I think, written over 30 books together. And we have our little publishing company. We've done. I've directed shows at Emma's Theatre that she used to run for 17 years, and we work together a great deal in our lives.
The happy discovery was that we have very complementary but different strengths.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that helps. While we're both happy to admit that we're very bossy individuals, both of us. We're not competitive with each other in that way. We don't argue about who's right or whatever. We have a sort of a tacit understanding between us that when we're collaborating creatively, the best idea wins. And somehow we seem to know what that best idea is. And
we sometimes finish each other's sentences, and
as you
are identical, and it's hilarious and quite wonderful.
So the format of the show is that of you introduce the topic of the day, and then you bring in a guest, and you've had such amazing guests from Alec Baldwin to Sarah Bareilles to Josh Bell, Titus Burgess, Josh Groban, Idina Menzel. I mean, these are all people that are very, very busy, as are you guys. Are you shooting in New York, or where are you doing production here?
We shot in Long Island at a studio mid-island in the town of Bethpage. So it was a fairly easy
at the Grumman Studios?
Yes, exactly.
So Grumman Studios is where they've been doing a lot of the NBC Live shows as well.
That's right. Yeah, the Grease Live and the Sound of Music Live and so forth were all shot there.
It's a good facility, and it's convenient and easy, and the actors can get there easily, too.
Sure.
It's not too bad.
But we were so blessed by the artists that came on board and agreed to do the show because...
Well, I think they're as passionate as we are about this particular subject. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was so happy to see that you have John Tartaglia and Jennifer Barnhart from Avenue Q.
Oh,
yes.
My gosh.
They are so talented. John writes a great deal himself, and it is, if we are... going to have a second season, which we'll know fairly soon. He will be writing a couple of the scripts for us, and they're both superb actors and puppeteers, and it's such a joy because I don't see them that much. I just see the puppets that they're manipulating, but they are so good.
They're really the unsung heroes of the show.
They are, and all the puppeteers are, and it makes my job so easy because they're so real and funny and endearing, and it's just a joy to work with them. It's a great sandbox in which to play.
Given the fact that it's called the Green Room, Julie's Green Room, we've all been in a number of green rooms that haven't been remotely green. Is the set green, in fact, because the kids would take it literally?
Well, we actually introduced the concept of the green room in the first episode, and Mom sets it up for the kids by saying, this room is called the green room, And one of the little puppet kids says, because it's green. And she says, well, ours is, but not all of them are.
Uh-huh.
But they are always the place where one gathers backstage to learn lines and to rest and to talk about the show and so forth.
I checked the definition again, and apparently it seems that it's because the original one in the late 1600s was painted green. But then I believe it took on the connotation that it's called the green room because that's where you get sick because you're so nervous when you're about to talk.
I've never heard that one. There are so many theories out there as to what the origin of the
term. I have my own personal theory about it, which is that it's... I'm not sure about it, and I can't be certain, but it comes from, I believe, something like Cockney rhyming slang. There are so many times the people in the theater will say, see you on the green, which means see you on the green gauge, which is Cockney rhyming slang for stage.
The slage.
And so if you shorten that, it becomes see you on the green. And I believe it might have stemmed from something like that.
Hmm.
I don't know why, but there you are.
So a number of the characters on Julie's Green Room are puppets, for those who haven't seen the show yet. And the puppets are created
by
the...
All my pupils are puppets,
And they're created by the Jim Henson Company. So
right.
You have the Avenue Q John Tartaglia puppets coming up against the Jim Henson puppets. Is there any rumbles there on the set there?
Well, John Tartaglia, of course, started his life as a puppeteer on Sesame Street when he was 15. So... it's a big love fest. You know, all the puppeteers have worked for Henson Company before in many different capacities. Some of them were on Avenue Q. All of them have been on Sesame Street or in other Henson productions. It's a fairly small world, the puppetry community. So they all know each other. They've all worked together before. There's a lot of overlap. And as I said, they really are the unsung heroes and the most amazing people. You can imagine that someone who spends their entire life behind the scenes, never actually seen, you know, creating a character for children primarily, except obviously in instances of like Avenue Q, they have huge hearts and they do it because they're passionate about it.
There's that quality to all of them that's gentle, kind, caring, compassionate,
a little shy, except for John Tartaglia.
One of your guests is David Hyde Pierce. Have you seen or will you be seeing him in Hello, Dolly?
We will definitely be seeing him. But what a review they had this morning. Oh, my goodness. That was astonishing. And it's so exciting. He is brilliant. He's actually, I think he makes us laugh almost as much as anyone on the show, doesn't he, Mom?
Yeah, it was lovely doing the show with him. And he enhanced that particular episode wonderfully. His wonderful deadpan. Your sense of humor, and
I think that's one of my favorite episodes.
It's one of the second to last
episode, and it's that classic moment before opening night when everything at the dress rehearsal goes wrong. And he's just, you know, he silently suffers through most of it.
Have you shot all your episodes for this season already?
Yes. They're all done. The 13 episodes for this season.
And they're all up on Netflix as we speak. They're all streaming now, so you can binge watch if you like.
I only saw the first five or six on Netflix. I didn't know all of them are up. We'll have to check that out.
Yeah,
well, what's really nice, as you say, is getting kids' interest in the arts. So we hope that your Miss Julie leads to their finding out about Strindberg's Miss Julie as time goes on.
Yes, a lot of people have asked bringing together of the two, any correlation. I said, well, I'd never thought of that, but... you can make of it what you like. I'm just a character. I'm not Julie Andrews. I'm just Miss Julie, and I have a lovely assistant played by a wonderful gentleman called
Julian.
Julian
Joiello.
Yeah, we call him. He's called Gus in the show, and he's my kind of man Friday, and helps me with everything to do with the theater, and so he's. He's talented and has a great singing voice and is a wonderful help.
Yeah, his voice sounds really beautiful on the album.
And, of course, we have a duck and a dog.
Yes.
Because the theater never discriminates.
Yeah.
It's the willing suspension of disbelief that all the students there recognize every single star who walks through the door but doesn't recognize Miss Julie. So.
That's right.
Well, that's because
she's Miss Julie, and
that's
I'm
right.
Miss Julie, yes.
So, Julie and Emma, thank you so much for joining us on Broadway Radio. I know that you guys have a very busy schedule, and we're very excited that you were able to come here and talk to us about Julie's Green Room, which is playing on Netflix right now. So get over there and check out Netflix. They have 13 30-minute episodes that are out there with starring all these Broadway stars we know and love. Thank you so much again.
Thank you very much, all of you. It was lovely talking to you.
Aren't you nice?
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Oh, little things can go quite wrong. And yes, some big things too.
But when that happens, there's a way to dive in and push through.
When feeling low and in a mess, with mishaps by the heap.
Don't give up. You'll find success if you just take a leap. Take a leap, take a leap. When you doubt that you'll get through it, take a leap, take a leap. Tell yourself that you can do it. Take a leap of faith, and here is why. Your fear will disappear, 'cause when you leap, you fly.
So Peter recorded on a different day and is not with us today with Carrie and Michael. And so we're going to play Peter's segment on Indecent next, and let's get Carrie in right after that. Okay, Peter, you also got to see Indecent, so tell us what you thought of that.
Well, the funny thing about Indecent is that this is a play that doesn't have an intermission, but it really is a two-act play. And why do I say that? Well, the first act, so to speak, deals with the production of God of Vengeance, a 1906 play that was really hot stuff. Remember, 1906, and it deals with lesbianism, it deals with brothels, and wow, you know, for 111 years ago, that's amazing stuff. What Paula Vogel, the excellent playwright, and by the way, she conceived this with Rebecca Teichman, who's done a spectacular job of directing. What they devised here is to show that when this play was produced in Europe, in Berlin, in Bratislava, in Constantinople, somewhere else too, that it was successful. It went on. People saw it. People went home. People talked about it. And that was it. When it came to America, however, you know our puritanical standards, it was closed down. Okay, that's essentially the first act of the play. Now, what happens after that? I mean, in a way you might say, well, I guess the story's over. They closed it down. Okay, that's the end of it. Well, no, there's much more to be told. And it's very hard to talk about this without giving away. So I'm going to dance around it and hope I can keep the mystery that Paula Vogel and Rebecca Teichman have done so well. And that is, they return home and they start putting on the play there. You're very curious when you see that they're in a makeshift theater, not a theater at all, a room in which they've set up chairs, and they're doing act two of the play, they say. Well, why not act one? Why not act three? Well, in fact, act one was last week, and next week is going to be act three. Why are they only doing an act at a time? There's a damn good reason for it. And what it brings up here is that because America rejected these people went on to have a very hard time in their lives. And what's again, I want to be purposely enigmatic here. I do not want to give anything away, but this is really must-see theater. And there's some visual images that are really striking. Now, we saw this play last year at this time at the Vineyard Theater, which has an off-Broadway space with a much smaller stage. Boy, this is a big play, and it fills the court theater stage beautifully. And again, there's something about Teichman's direction that where she puts people are exactly where they should be at that moment. It's so beautifully blocked. The stage pictures are glorious, even though there's no scenery. The actors provide the scenery themselves but through her direction because they just make such beautiful stage pictures, as I say. Well, there's also an image indicating death that's terrific. And there's also something about people standing in line. They do that twice, once in my, as I say, first act, so to speak, once in the second act, so to speak. And each of those lines has a very different meaning in each of those scenes. So I really do believe that this is mesmerizing. And as much as I liked it at the Vineyard, I savored it even more this time because now this big, big play has more space to breathe. And I really wish it well.
So, Carrie, what did you think about Indecent?
Oh, my goodness. Well, my friends and I went through about a pack of tissues during the show. First off, let's just take a moment for the fact that Paula Vogel is finally on Broadway.
Yay.
Long overdue, in my opinion. And that play could not be more timely, more powerful, more sadly relevant right now to be seeing it after Sean Spicer's comments, flubs, appalling statements regarding the Holocaust is one of the many reasons my friend and I were both crying quite a bit. But political relevance aside, I think that it is beautifully, beautifully staged. I think that it is so well directed. The cast is extraordinary, and it's one of the many reasons I wish there was a Tony Award for Best Ensemble, because that cast is working so well together. I think it's an incredibly important play, but I also think it's just an incredibly well done play. I thought everyone's performances were great. I loved the transitions between scenes. The music was wonderful. And as a former band geek, I was very impressed by the clarinet, which I used to play. I loved it. It's my choice for best play of the year. I can't stop thinking about it.
All right, Michael, what did you think?
I completely agree. It's a beautiful play. Paula was there the night I went, and I got to take her hand afterwards and told her how much I loved it. It's a major work, very, very moving, as Carrie says, especially in view of recent incredible, horrifying comments by certain people. Carrie, do you know how, I just wanted to check this, the pronunciation of the director, would it be Rebecca Teichman?
Teichman, yeah, that's the trap of the print journalist. I sometimes don't know how to pronounce names.
Okay, all right, well, I'm glad I asked. So
the co-author, she and Paula have been working on it together for many years.
So I'm sorry, Teichman?
Yeah, Rebecca Teichman.
Okay, yeah, the billing is Indecent by Paula Vogel, created by Paula Vogel and Rebecca Teichman, which is it. No, I mean, I'm not correcting you. I'm just, I find that very interesting. And then, of course, directed by Rebecca Teichman. And absolutely, the staging is as extraordinary as the writing. The history, I'm not sure what Peter said in his comments, so we don't want to repeat everything, but it's basically this play is about the creation of the play God of Vengeance by Sholem Ash, which originally premiered in Warsaw in 1907 and then premiered at the Provincetown Playhouse in Greenwich Village in 1922. That theater still exists. It is now part of NYU, but it does still exist and is still used as a theater. So the history, I mean, I always get chills when I think that you could actually go to that theater and it's still there. You know, it's really amazing. The God of Vengeance, the original play by Sholem Ash, was apparently not tremendously controversial when it was done in Europe, but then it came to America and people got all crazy. And the ironic thing is that the plot basically concerns a Jewish owner of a brothel, a house of prostitution, who has a daughter, and the daughter winds up becoming involved romantically and sexually with one of the girls from the house of prostitution. But the thing that apparently the main thing that caused the controversy in this country was not the fact that this guy is a brothel owner, but just the very fact that there is a lesbian love scene between the two women. So, you know, one could go on and on about the things that people get upset about and don't get upset about. But I just think that's incredibly telling. The shifts between the telling of the history of the God of Vengeance and the playing out of actual scenes from the play are beautifully done. There is a lot of music, a lot of songs in the show. Let's see, one, two, three, about 12 No, I'm sorry, more than that. Well, there are actual songs that are sung in full, and then there's a lot of background music played by the onstage musicians. I almost joked to Paula afterwards that maybe the show should be nominated for Best Musical, but I thought she might take that the wrong way. So I didn't say that. But the music adds greatly to it, and the choreography, and the cast is across the board really superb. I particularly enjoyed Richard Topol, who I guess you would say is more or less the as close as we can come to a narrator, especially in starting off the show. But everyone else, Adina Versen, Stephen Ratazzi, Tom Mellis, Katrina Lenk, Mimi Lieber, Max Gordon Moore, Matt Dario, Lisa Gutkin, Aaron Halva, Eleanor Reisa, Andrea Goss, Ben Cherry, Zoe Aqua, Yuri Sharlin, and Doug Wieselman. And to see it also in at the Court, which is a theater that's not famous for having hits for a number of reasons. I thought it was great that this play is there and revivifying that theater. I think it's
the theater where The Diary of Anne Frank was first played.
Thank you. Talk about history again. It's just amazing. I think this is a major work, and it's going to go down in theater history. And I hope that it is recognized come awards time by the various awards organizations.
I interviewed Paula about it for an article for the Culture Trip, and we were talking about how it was when it was done off Broadway and the transfer was announced was before the election. And she told me that she had thought there would be two glass ceilings shattered with Hillary in the White House and her on Broadway. And now, given the discussion regarding immigration with this country, another scene that I thought was so beautifully, simply staged and so powerful, with the cast coming to America and following Trump's Muslim bans, amongst other things. It's such an important play right now. I really, really hope it's recognized and that more people will go see it, because I think it's going to be eye-opening for many, many audience members.
I almost forgot to mention that about 2 weeks before seeing Indecent, I was lucky enough to see the new Yiddish rep production of The God of Vengeance in Yiddish at the theater at St. Clement's. They got a tremendous amount of press for that production, as you might imagine. I think that this was a remounting, and I suppose they knew from the beginning that Indecent would be coming to, well, first off Broadway and then on Broadway. So I guess that's why they chose now to do it. But I'm very, very glad that I got to see the actual play complete in Yiddish with English subtitles, super titles, of course. That just enriched the Indecent experience even more.
Was their staging of the rain scene, was that as powerful as the way it was presented in Indecent?
Well, I mean, the acting and the text were, and the fact that it was in Yiddish, it was a very, very, very minimalist production at the theater at St. Clement's. Basically no sets, certainly no rain effect. But in the most important way, it was as moving, yes. Mm-hmm.
All right, Peter, you saw Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, so why don't you give us your review?
Well, this is a property I've never responded to in any of its movie iterations. I have seen the original Gene Wilder movie, and I have seen the Johnny Depp movie, and I've been pretty appalled by them. James, you're a parent, I'm a parent, and the idea of watching your kids being destroyed is something that doesn't bring me any pleasure, and I can't imagine it would bring you any pleasure either. David Lindsay Abaire once told me the reason he wrote Rabbit Hole is because somebody said to him, "What's the worst thing you could ever imagine happening?" And he said, "Well, having my child killed." And you watch these parents see their children killed. And, you know, why are these children killed? Because one is spoiled. Okay. You know, and that's the parents' fault. Another one blows gum quite a bit. Another one is a kid who in this iteration is obsessed with cell phones and technology and is always on his iPhone playing video games and what have you. And, you know, I mean, sure, none of these kids is appealing, but let the punishment fit the crime. I mean, it's really quite wrong to see Willy Wonka destroy them, and more to the point, not care after he does it. I mean, he doesn't offer any sympathy whatsoever. He really feels that he's well within his rights to do this. Now, this said, this has obviously been a tremendously successful property. It's the first movie, at least, has hung around for a long time and is beloved. And I do like the songs from the original movie and the songs in the new songs by Mark Shaiman and Scott Whitman are fine. No problems there. But I just am repulsed by the story. And but I seem to be in the minority here, and that's perfectly fine. I've been there before. I'll be there again. The audience was crazy for it, and it's been doing sensational business, as you know. The friend I bought greatly enjoyed seeing the kids being murdered because, as he said to me afterwards, no, they're terrible kids, and most people are assholes. And that may very well be, but I don't think that the punishments are commensurate with the crimes, and I do feel bad about it. A lot of people have complained that it isn't as ornate as it was in England. I did see it there, by the way, and it was more ornate there, but I don't think it's lost anything by being a little less ornate here because there's a stylization to it that works very nicely. I have no problem with the with our Willy Wonka of Christian Borle. He works extraordinarily hard. It's a very odd show, too, by the way, in the sense that he has virtually nothing to do in the first act because it centers on Charlie, the little boy, who's intent on finding this golden ticket so he can get into the factory. I wish there was something more to it than that, that this is the goal to get into the factory. I like when he tries to share the chocolate bar with his infirm relatives, but boy, you know, I mean, all this to do just to get into a factory. Yes, it is true that Willy Wonka is going to give the factory to the kid he likes the most. And I do like in this version, unlike the movie, that he makes that clear to us anyway. He confides that to us right at the top of the show. Because you, in the movie, you really wonder, why are these people going through this? What's in it for them? We don't understand that. And even though they're not told that, at least we understand what's going to happen. The kid I saw, well, there are three kids playing the part. And I don't know, have you ever heard, James, that when there's a firing squad executing somebody who's been condemned to death, that some of the rifles are blank, have blanks in them, because that way people can who are shooting can convince yeah. themselves that he or she wasn't the killer?
Absolutely.
Well, I'm going to do something vaguely similar in saying that the kid I saw I thought was putrid, but I'm not going to tell you which of the three I saw. Doesn't know what to do with his arms, scrunches his face up quite a bit, overacts. I think it's a performance that would embarrass a community theater. And but again, his secret is safe with me. I'm not going to say who it was. I can only hope that those who do go don't see this kid. And the odds, of course, are 2-1 that they won't. Of course, for all I know, the other kids are just as bad or worse. And again, this is what Jack O'Brien obviously wanted or settled for. I think it moves extraordinarily well, an amazingly slick show. But boy, you know, it just doesn't appeal to me on any level. And the person I brought said, well, you just don't like fantasy. That's all. You just don't like fantasy. I certainly like The Wizard of Oz when people at the end of the show are saying, where's the brain you promised Scarecrow? Where's the heart you promised Tin Man? They don't say, where's my heart? Where's my brain? No, they're out for the other people, and I like that very much. You know, I certainly like High Spirits and Blithe Spirit, and I've even written a play where there's a ghost, so how much could I not take to fantasy? I mean, I don't think that's it. It's just this fantasy truly rubs me the wrong way. But again, look at the business. Look at the acclaim. Look at the hand claps. Look at the standing ovation. Look at all that. And that's what's going on at the L'Enfantin Theater. And as always, I'd rather have people have a good time than agree with me. But boy, this was a painful night for me. Oh, One other thing, John Rubinstein is tremendous. He's really excellent as well, playing the grandfather who takes Charlie into the factory. He's unrecognizable. He's made a character completely his own. He's really found it. He's nailed it. He's so centered. It's a marvelous, marvelous performance. And I really, really enjoyed seeing him. It took me a few minutes to realize that was he. But it is he, and don't be surprised if you don't recognize him either.
Peter, you also saw The Little Foxes. So which cast did you see?
Well, I saw Laura Linney play Regina, and I saw Cynthia Nixon play Birdie. So, and I certainly look forward to seeing Cynthia Nixon play Regina and Laura Linney play Birdie. It'll be very interesting to see if I feel that one is superior to the other. But at this point, I can't imagine either one of them being better than the other. But I'm not going to go and second guess or even first guess under the circumstances these two fine, fine actresses. When Cynthia Nixon as Birdie made her final exit, you knew we were seeing her for the last time. I said, I hope this audience gives her an exit hand, and I'm not going to start it. I don't want to be the one to do it. I want to see if somebody else will do it. And indeed, somebody did, and the audience really responded with tremendous, tremendous applause. Now, in this play, where we deal with the Giddens and the Hubbards, Regina was originally a Hubbard, but she married Horace Giddens, and she and her two brothers are interested in making a big deal that's going to make them, as she says, millionaires. She's not above cutting her two brothers down to size and hoping that she can get a bigger share of things because she really is quite the manipulator. But what I found really interesting is they have a maid, Addie, wonderfully played by Carolyn Stephanie Clay. And at one point she serves elderberry wine. And of course, whenever many of us hear the words elderberry wine, we think of arsenic and old lace, because that was the wine that the two Brewster sisters gave to the men that they met who they felt were down and out and were better off dead. And you really, in a way, hope that this is the elderberry wine that she got from the Brewster sisters, because these people deserve to die. They are truly horrible people. Foxes may even be a euphemism for what they really are. There is a decent man on the scene, though, and that is Horace Giddens, Regina's husband, played by Richard Thomas. Now, he's supposed to be very, very ill. And it's a little tricky watching Richard Thomas when we first meet him. He's just come back from being away for 5 months in a hospital. And yet he seemed a little too healthy to me. Now, it could be effectively argued that one of the reasons he's so to speak, healthy and full of beans is that he's back home and he's hoping to get a new start with his wife. And he's with his daughter again, whom he adores, and she adores him. So you could look at it that way. But he seemed almost like a hypochondriac to me in the early scenes. But he does get progressively worse. Laura Linney really is very good at turning on the charm and letting people know that she can turn it off right away. She's not shy to let you see that it's a facade. She doesn't care. What really is going on here is she is showing you, I will be pleasant as long as I need to be. But you know, and I know, that when things get tough, the tough get things, to quote Mark O'Donnell, who coined that line. It's a favorite of mine. And it's a very different Regina in that way. Most Reginas don't have this underbelly of, you know, that I'm just being nice for the time being. Yeah, and the fangs will come out when they have to come out. So she makes no bones about it, no apologies. There is one moment in the play, again, purposely enigmatic here, when she crosses her legs, and I've got to check and see if that's a stage direction that Lillian Hellman put in. I've seen the play a few times, dating back to the famous Mike Nichols revival, which opened with Anne Bancroft and Margaret Leighton. I didn't see Anne Bancroft. I saw Margaret Leighton take over Regina. But I've never noticed this before, the crossing of the legs at one moment, which makes such a statement. Now, the real revelation, you know, I mean, we knew that Laura Linney is one of our most accomplished actresses. We know that of Cynthia Nixon, too. The real revelation in this show that really flabbergasted me is Michael McCain, who plays Ben, one of the brothers. Because we think of him as a comic actor. I mean, after all, he took over for Harvey Fierstein in Hairspray. So we've never seen him be so dramatic, and he's almost unrecognizable. He's that good an actor that he's able to become a completely different person from any we've ever seen of him. And I wouldn't be surprised if his relatives came and didn't recognize him, not only in the way he looks, but also in his demeanor. He is more than up to this dramatic task. So this is a first-class revival, and I am thrilled that I'm going to get the chance to see it again, and I hope I get to see it again and again. I've always loved the play, but it's very nice to see a production that's worthy of it, too.
Okay, Carrie, you also saw The Little Foxes. So what is your thoughts on this show?
I saw it last night with Laura Linney as Regina, and I thought it was a delicious production. I think Laura has such an incredibly sympathetic air about her naturally. I've said before that one of my goals in life is to just have her give me a hug. So seeing her in this calculating, cunning, duplicitous role was really delightful. Being from the South myself, I grew up in Charleston. I also really enjoy seeing the sort of darkness and malice that can lurk behind the Southern manners and gentility. A lot of us in Charleston say that the phrase "bless your heart" is actually a way of saying "screw you." And I thought it was a fascinating show trying to understand Regina's motivations and to see why she was doing what she was doing and how trapped women were economically at that time. And I thought that she did a great job of communicating how trapped and claustrophobic Regina was without making it a little too heavy-handed. Like, this is why you should have sympathy for this person. I thought the whole cast was fantastic. Cynthia Nixon was great as Bertie. All of the men were really, really well done. The costumes and the set were gorgeous as par for the course at MTC. I love seeing the sets at the Friedman Theater. I think they're always beautiful. But it really is, in my opinion, Regina's show. And I can't wait to see it again. I can't wait to see the women swap roles. I do think it's worth noting how heartbreaking Cynthia Nixon was as Bertie in the without giving too much away, the very frank discussion she has about her own marriage. And that, again, that highlights the only way women could get out of their father's house was to go into someone else's house at that point. And Cynthia, also another compelling and fascinating woman to watch on stage, I thought was wonderful in that part. And I'm very excited to see them swap roles, hopefully next week.
You know, I haven't seen the show yet. I can't wait to see it. But I find it so fascinating just to have read people's comments before the show, before seeing the show, as to whether they felt Laura was better casting as Regina or Bertie, or if Cynthia was better casting as Regina or Bertie. And people seem to have very different opinions on that. Have you encountered this difference of opinion, Carrie?
I try to not read anything until I've seen the show. That's sometimes impossible because people will write all caps reviews on Facebook. but I try to tune that out as much as I can. Laura did a talk with the League of Professional Theater Women about a month ago that I went to, and she said that when she was approached about the show, that she didn't think of herself as a Regina, that she thought of herself more as a Bertie. And that I believe she was the one who suggested to get Cynthia involved and have them swap roles, if I'm recalling that correctly. I haven't read or discussed it really with anyone because I just saw it last night.
Right.
But I think that one of the most exciting things about going to see a play with an actor like Laura Linney or Cynthia Nixon is to be surprised.
Yes.
And to have whatever preconceived notions you might have completely disproven. And I've seen Laura in dozens and dozens of films. I loved her work in The Big C. And I was really excited to see her take on a character that isn't exactly written to be the most sympathetic, or to use the word that's always applied to female characters, likable. I thought it was really exciting to see her basically be a words I shouldn't say on a podcast on stage.
I think you could say that word, but that's okay if you don't want to. I just wanted to clarify. I wasn't talking about reviews that I've read. I'm just talking about comments of people who had not seen the show yet and just saying what their perceptions of the casting was as to who would be better in which role based on their previous work. And it's just so interesting that it was really across, just so different. People would have arguments as to why they felt Laura was better suited for Regina or why she was better suited for Birdie and Cynthia, for both roles also. And I guess it depends on what you've seen them in. But also, as you very correctly note, these are both excellent actresses and they both have range. And I'm pretty sure that they're probably excellent in both roles.
Carrie, are you scheduled to go back again to see in the reverse?
Yes.
All right. So we'll have to get an update from you after you see it again. I'm going to actually see it this afternoon and hopefully have the same experience that you're having, which seems to be what everybody else is saying. So I'm very excited to see this.
I want a lot of people I went to high school with down in Charleston to see it.
All right. And women who have determined their own fate. We talk about war paint in Carrie, you got a chance to see that as well. So what was your take on war paint?
Well, I wish I had dressed up more. I felt very underdressed. Costumes were wonderful. I mean, seriously wonderful. That must have been so much fun to design the wardrobes for those characters. I really enjoyed it. I will admit that I kind of had the thought, why was this written by and directed by all men when it's about these two women? And that's not to say that I don't think men can write well about women, because they very much can. But I did wonder if I would be rolling my eyes at certain times. But overall, I was really, really pleased with how both women were written, how it passed the Bechdel test, yes, there were conflicts regarding men, but it didn't feel as heavy-handed as other productions that I'm not going to name have felt at times. I thought that it was kind of painful to watch at times following, Hillary Clinton's loss in the election. I really enjoyed the song "If I'd Been a Man" and the lyric "Would I Win If I Had Been a Man," and I kind of had to button my lips to not shout something from the audience at that moment. I thought that both performances were wonderful, although I did not always understand what Patty was singing, and I wish that I could, because that's a fascinating character, but at times her accent was a little too heavy for me to catch all the lyrics. And Christine Ebersole can read or sing almost anything and make it sound mournful and wistful, I think. And she did such a wonderful, wonderful job in her performance. I cannot wait to get the cast recording and listen to the song Pink again. That one was especially moving, I thought. And I just wish it didn't feel as timely as it does today. I could go on and on about powerful women being stereotyped or held back, but that's a different podcast, I think. But I really enjoyed the show. I'm glad that it came to Broadway. It, as someone who doesn't enjoy going to Sephora to buy makeup, I really don't like buying makeup. I really enjoyed the subject. It was fascinating to learn about those two women because I didn't know that much about them. And I don't think anyone could deliver Patty's line of that she couldn't buy the apartment, so she bought the building instead. Better than Patty did the night I saw it.
We should mention that the outstanding costume design was Catherine Zuber, who is a theater Hall of Famer, and as well as I think she's got 4.5 million Tony Awards, but, something like that.
Carrie, I think if you had worn a hat, you probably would have felt more comfortable.
That was my fascinator at home that night, sadly.
Well,
spectacular hats on.
Well, you'll get a chance to wear a hat again because Catherine Zuber is scheduled to design the costumes for My Fair Lady revival coming up in 2018. So if anything, we can all wear a hat to that one.
As long as we take them off when the show begins.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Unlike some audiences.
I was sitting behind somebody for a show a couple of weeks ago. I can't remember what show it was. But this person didn't have a hat on, but chose to wear their hair in a bun on the top of their head. And I couldn't see this. I had to look around this person. Is there etiquette about that? Can you please take your bun down? I mean, so Michael, last week or perhaps the week before, we talked briefly about Daniel's husband at Primary Stages, and you got a chance to see that. So why don't you tell us what you thought of that?
I would love to. Before I do, I wanted to say that recently someone remarked online somewhere, a rhetorical question, is this the richest theater season we've seen in a very long time? And I would say absolutely yes, not only on Broadway, but also off Broadway. It's incredible, the generally really high level of quality of almost everything I've seen lately. And also not one show that I would say is anything close to being a flop or a failure from an artistic standpoint. Some more perfect than others, some more flawed than others, but it's really astounding. I guess things go in cycles, but I'm really enjoying this part of the cycle, I have to tell you. In a way, it's overwhelming to have so much quality happen at once, but of course, it's very lovely in the final analysis. Daniel's Husband, which Peter loved, and which I had not planned to see, only because I, as I said, things have been so busy, I couldn't schedule it at first. I had trouble figuring out when I might see it. But he loved it so much that I thought I really have to get to this, also because of the subject matter. And I'm so glad I did. It's a beautiful play. Again, not perfect, some flaws, but the flaws in this case, I would say they really almost disappear in when you look at the quality of the play as a whole and the production as a whole and the how moving the story is and the talent of the playwright, Michael McKeever. This production is directed by Joe Brancato, and the cast is Anna Holbrook, Lou Liberatore, Matthew Montelongo, Ryan Spahn, and Leland Wheeler. And again, Peter already discussed, so I won't go into great detail, but it's about this gay male couple who've been together for, I believe they say, 7 years. They are very much a couple in every way. They live together in a home. They act as if they are married, but they are not legally married. And the situation here, which turns out to be very, very significant, is that one of them wants to get married and the other one does not. And he goes through the whole litany of, why should we emulate outmoded heterosexual traditions of marriage that are really, was it really only a social and economic construct and blah, blah, blah. And he goes through all of that. It's not that he doesn't love his partner. He loves him very, very much. He just is opposed to marriage from an ideological standpoint, I guess you would say. Interestingly enough, that part of the story, that debate, also arises in Gently Down the Stream, the Martin Sherman play at the Public Theater, which I just recently saw also. And there was a talk back after Daniel's Husband with the writer, unfortunately, wasn't there, but the cast and several of the primary stages people and one of the producers. And I said, I made note of how this theme comes up in both of the plays, almost in some of the same lines. It's really incredible. Now, the two plays are very different in many other ways, but as far as gay marriage, it does seem that it's very, very much in the ether at the moment, as far as something that people are really thinking about. And of course, especially again, and the point was made during the talk back with the horrendous election in November and the assault on all kinds of civil rights that has been happening since then. So I can't say too much more about the plot of Daniel's Husband, and if you see it, you'll understand why. It's tremendously moving. It has I'm sorry, I didn't check the closing date. I think it has another week or two at most at down at the Cherry Lane Theater. But if you don't catch this production, please look for it in the future. It's really extraordinary.
Carrie, you also got a chance to see Amelie with Philippa Sue and the rest of the folks out there. So tell us, what did you think of Amelie?
I was a little let down by that one. I think that the movie is a wonderful film, but it's such a cinematic experience that I was very curious to see how it would be adapted to the stage. And it just left me kind of flat. I've seen so many musicals by this point in my life that I can sort of tell which number is going to do this and which number is going to do this and what's going to be the act one closer and what's going to be the second to last song in the show. And I could tell when all of those were coming in Amelie. What I did not see coming was the Elton John number. Well, the man performing it, I thought, did a fantastic impression of Elton John. I did not really understand what was going on. I shot a glance at my plus one at that show, and he looked equally as puzzled as I felt. And it just, I also didn't really see the gnome number coming. I think that despite a very talented cast, Philip has sounded incredible, and the sky is blue, and Adam was was great, and everyone I thought was giving it their all, but the material just didn't take me away. It didn't sweep me up in that kind of enchantment that the movie did or that other musicals have done. I don't have a litmus test for an experience at a theater, but often I found that my best experiences are when I forget I'm at the theater, and I never forgot that I was watching a musical at that show.
I think that I'm really looking forward to the cast recording of this, and I'm really looking forward to 20 years from now when they rework it.
Yeah.
That there is a diamond in the rough there.
Yeah, I think you made that point last week, James, and I completely agree. I think that most of the problems are the staging and the direction and the production, the size of the production, and you know, it's hard to say, of course, but I think you're right, and I think that we will all find when we get the cast album that we're going to enjoy it a lot more.
Okay, let's switch gears for a second and head up to Lincoln Center, where we'll make a left-hand turn directly into the Metropolitan Opera. And Michael saw Der Rosenkavalier.
Der Rosenkavalier.
Der Rosenkavalier. So, Michael, tell us about that opera.
Well, it's a beautiful production conducted by Sebastian Weigel, directed by Robert Carson, set design Paul Steinberg, costume design Brigitte Reifenstuhl, lighting designers Robert Carson, Peter Van Preet, choreographer Philippe Giraudot, and it's a beautiful opera by Richard Strauss, and notable for many reasons, this production, but chiefly because it's going to be the last apparent apparently the last full operatic role to be sung by Renee Fleming in the role of the Marshalin. It has just very recently been announced that Miss Fleming will be on Broadway next season as Nettie Fowler in a new revival of Carousel. So Broadway's going to get her soon. Well, we already had her, ironically, in a straight play. But now she's going to be in Carousel next season. But in the meantime, if you are lucky and if tickets are still available, you can catch her over the next few weeks in De Rose and Cavalier at the Met. Physically, the production is gorgeous. It's a little unusual. It looks as if the scenes are taking place in to me, it seemed like in various rooms of a museum. But very, very beautiful. The action has been updated somewhat to the time when the opera was written, which is 1911. And it's set in Vienna. And it's a beautiful story about an older woman in love with a much younger man. And she kind of knows from the beginning that this is not going to last forever, but she's really appreciating a while it's lasting. Renee Fleming character in the Marshalin, and the young man is named Octavian, played by Alina Garanka and sung by Alina Garanka. And then, Octavian is the deliverer of a marriage proposal to another younger woman on the part of an older man named Baron Ox. This Baron Ox, who's really kind of a oafish, very vulgar character, real male chauvinist pig, very similar character to Carl Magnus in A Little Night Music. So he has Octavian deliver this rose as a proposal of marriage to a young woman named Sophie. But guess what happens? Octavian and Sophie fall in love at first sight. So they end up together, and the Marshalin realizes that that's how it should be, that the young people should be together. And this is all done with incredibly gorgeous music by Strauss and a beautiful production, as I said. I think it is a very excellent choice of a final operatic role for Miss Fleming, and I'm sure that many of her fans will be looking forward to seeing what her Broadway career and her post-operatic career is going to amount to. I'm sure it's going to be very, very, very full and very rich. She still looks incredible. And as far as I could hear, her voice is completely 100% intact. So I'm really looking forward to see what happens for her in the future.
Carrie, you got over to the St. James Theater where you saw Present Laughter. So tell us, what did you think about Present Laughter?
Well, I'm kind of sad that my friend and I didn't, is it pronounced cosplay or cosplay? We said we were going to wear silk dressing gowns to the theater that night, but we didn't.
cosplay, yes. That's right. I did, Laura and I saw you outside of the theater that night. That's right.
Yeah. Yes, Ariel and I had joked that we were going to wear silk dressing gowns, but we decided not to, but I'm kind of sad we didn't. That was just a delight. That was such a delight. I did see the production with Victor Garber. I think it was about 7 or 8 years ago, but none of it felt tired to me. It was such an energetic cast. And just having a blast up there. It's not my favorite script. It's pretty self-indulgent, I think. And as a loud and proud feminist, there were times where if I had known that man myself, I probably would have throttled him. But I will say that Kevin Kline made him a very attractive man-child. And just watching a bunch of really talented actors be very silly was a great escape from the world right now. And I was so impressed by Kobe Smulders, so impressed by her performance. I thought that she sounded like a combination of Deborah Kerr and Grace Kelly with her accent, that it wasn't affected, that she seemed very comfortable and graceful on stage. And just really, I didn't see Robin Sparkles at all from How I Met Your Mother.
Yeah.
And for someone who's done such a popular role on such a popular show for so many years, to not associate that at all with the performance in front of me, I thought was a very successful performance. The whole cast was fantastic. Kate Burton, Christine Nielsen, everyone was such a delight to watch. And you can tell they're having a great time. And I can't believe I haven't seen Kevin Kline do Noel Coward before now, frankly, because it seems like such a perfect fit for him, for his mannerisms and his obvious intelligence and class. And frankly, he was very sexy. I will say that he was a very, very sexy man on stage. And he needed to be sexy to make us believe that all those women are falling all over him and putting up with his nonsense.
That's an interesting point about him not doing Coward. I'm not aware of him ever doing Coward before. It does seem such a natural fit. He's been, I think, very picky and choosy about his projects over the years, for whatever reasons. And I'm so glad he got around to this, even though we've had so many productions. This is the fourth Broadway production of this play that I've seen. Beginning with George C. Scott and Kate Burton, who is now playing Liz, who originally played Daphne, which is the role that's now being so delightfully played by Tedra Millen, who was on our podcast a couple of weeks ago. And as far as the, clarify that I completely agree about Gary Essendine's behavior towards the women, especially in certain scenes. But I guess in this case, I feel like it's okay because we're certainly meant to feel that he's being a cad. It's not as if it's being portrayed as this is a way that one should behave. And he does sort of, he doesn't exactly get his comeuppance, but I think we're meant to think that he grows during the play. So I think that's the point that Coward was trying to get at.
I'm shocked to hear that somebody would think that Noel Coward's being self-indulgent.
Well, I did also note on a related note, I always find that Coward the stuff is wonderful, but he tends to overwrite. Do you notice that there are scenes that go on long after they've made their point? And I think, especially in a comedy, that they don't have to be quite so long. I wish he had had a little more talent for editing himself, because this is a wonderful play overall, but I do think it could certainly be trimmed more than a little bit.
That's a sentiment that's said quite a bit about today by today's audience about plays that were written a long time ago.
Oh, sure, sure.
That, our attention spans nowadays are pathetic. And excuse me. Most people in the theater industry now, I hear them say, "Oh, everything should be 90 minutes, no intermission."
I don't feel that, and there are also, I mean, there are several very long plays that I don't feel that about, but I noticed that in Coward. And even in Private Lives, I think the first act is an absolute perfect piece of work, and then act two starts out well, and then it gets to be a bit of a slog for quite a while. That's just my feeling about Coward.
A friend and I were saying the other day that we want Kate McKinnon and Bryce Pinkham to do Private Lives in the future. I tweeted that, and Bryce said, "Where do I sign up?" So hopefully that will happen one day.
Yeah, he'd be great in Coward, I think.
Have either one of you heard about the Coward Estate? Will they let somebody cut the show?
Oh, I don't know. Ooh. Good question. Maybe
I wonder, you know, some estates are really like, yeah, sure, whatever you want. And then other estates are like, there's a comma there that you missed, you know? So that would be interesting to see if that's even an option right now for somebody to cut that up.
Even if it is an option, I think a lot of directors are very, very, very hesitant to do that because they know that lots of people are going to get on them for it.
All right. Before we wrap up for today, I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayVideo.com. There's a subscribe link that each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in iTunes. You can listen to us in many ways. One of the ways is the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone or your Android device. iHeartRadio plays us. Google Play plays us. TuneIn plays us on your Amazon Echo if you want to listen to us that way, as well as many different ways, including Broadway World Radio, which plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, for Michael, for Carrie, and for me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today. Okay, Peter, welcome back. do you have an answer to last week's trivia?
Sure. I had asked, I posed the point that Greta Garbo was a big silent film star. So when Sound Pictures began, MGM advertised that in her next picture, Garbo Talks. A Broadway play in the 60s made the same claim about a very different actress, so-and-so talks, in her second and final Broadway play. She'd already made a dynamic debut in her first one, one that later paid even bigger dividends in Hollywood. So I asked, who was the actress who talked, the name of the second play, and while we're at it, the name of the first play that became a movie as well. Okay, so the play was done in 1962. It was called Isle of Children, and the star was Patty Duke. And the ads went, Patty Duke talks, because aside from a bit of a wah-wah, she didn't speak anything in her first Broadway play, The Miracle Worker. So that was the answer. I was extraordinarily proud of Gregory Blazer, who got it in no time flat. Donald Tessioni, Fred Abramowitz, and Brigadoon, whoever he or she may be, I guess it's a guy, were the people who followed. So, new one. Why are these musicals in this order? The Phantom of the Opera, Crazy for You, Mr. Wonderful, South Pacific, Carrie, Chicago, Miss Liberty, Hairspray, Fiddler on the Roof, 110 in the Shade, Anything Goes, and A Bronx Tale. Once again, Phantom of the Opera, Crazy for You, Mr. Wonderful, South Pacific, Carrie, Chicago, Miss Liberty, Hairspray, Fiddler on the Roof, 110 in the Shade, Anything Goes, and A Bronx Tale. Why are they in that order?
Oh, my. So if you have an answer to that, email us at trivia@broadwayradio.com. We'll let you know if you're on the right track. So on behalf of Peter Felicia, Michael Portantier, and Carrie Purcell, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Videos This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Go on and write your story. Go on and build it word by word. You gotta tell your story. You gotta let your voice be heard. Start out with just one sentence, then another, then a third. Keep building up your story, and let your voice be, let your voice be heard.
If you're a dancer, if you have frizzy hair,
let your voice be heard.
If your skin is lighter brown,
or if you travel in a chair,
let your voice be heard.
No matter what we look like, no matter if we're young or old,
we all have stories, and our stories must be told.
Go on and write your story.
Go on and build it word by word.
You gotta tell your story.
You gotta let your voice be heard. Start out with just one sentence, then another, then a third. Keep building up your story, and let your voice be,
let your voice be heard.